In the name of one God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer of our lives. Amen. It's good to be back here this Sunday. Last Sunday, I was leading the Pro Mundi pilot retreat. As many of you know, 2 years ago, the Archbishop asked me to be part of a team that was going to charged with designing a new lay spiritual formation retreat here for the diocese, to develop a tool for the diocese. So I was part of that team in terms of developing it, and then last year we launched our pilots. So last October I was gone for 2 Sundays to do 2 pilot retreats, and I was gone in February to do a pilot retreat. We've had 3, and then this last Sunday was our 4th pilot retreat. We had 7 people from St. Lawrence in attendance. There were 30 overall, and I think it went really well. The purpose of the retreat is to get us thinking about prayer. Rather, as Anglicans, we're used to spoken prayer. We're used to spoken words. We're used to praying with words. But there's also a tradition, a stream of prayer as a posture of listening, as a posture of placing ourselves before God and being open and receptive to how God might be praying through us and how God might be speaking to us. So this retreat is actually all about that. It's all about how to develop a sense of prayer as listening. And we use various exercises and small group discussion to talk about prayer and our experience of God. And it seems like everybody is benefiting. And responding well. So we're going to have another retreat in March, which will be our kind of full launch of it as a thing. And my hope is that together as a community, we might be able to do it as a parish retreat and do it together as a retreat. So it's something that we at St. Lawrence could do. So that's where I was last weekend. Today, we have a story about James and John, the sons of Zebedee. They were fishermen on the Sea of Galilee, and when Jesus showed up one day and he said, "Come, follow me," James and John, these two brothers, left the nets and left their father's hired men, and they followed Jesus on this journey that took them to places they could not imagine. Jesus had a nickname for them. Jesus called them the Sons of Thunder. They're the only disciples in the Bible who apparently Jesus nicknames. I mean, he calls them the Sons of Thunder. And what I hear there is that they were bold, courageous, energetic men, right? Who were loud and had big personalities. The Sons of Thunder. And apparently Jesus liked them and felt fondly towards them. Throughout the book of Mark, there are certain moments where instead of dealing with the whole 12, Jesus deals with a small group. He deals with Peter, James, and John. When they're at the synagogue with Jairus and doing a healing, he takes Peter, James, and John. When he's on the mountain of Transfiguration getting transfigured, he takes Peter, James, and John. And when he's at Gethsemane, he takes Peter, James, and John. So in today's story, we have James and John coming to Jesus. And they're saying, "Jesus, we want you to do something for us." And Jesus says, "What do you want?" And they say, "When you come into your glory, we want to sit on your right and we want to sit on your left." What I hear there is just, this comes right after Jesus has said again that the Son of Man will be crucified and rise again. And that's been hard for the disciples to get. And so finally, it seems like Peter and James are finally saying, "Oh, okay, something's going to happen here. And when it happens, we want to sit on your left and we want to sit on your right. We want to be part of this thing," is what I hear. "And as we're part of this thing, we want to be in the center of it. We want to be, you know, at this heavenly banquet, and there's you on one side, and there's you in the middle, and we're on one side and another." And I hear they want to be close to Jesus, right? They want to be at the center of the action. And they feel like, well, there's only 2 places, and actually we might be the ones who are deserving of having these 2 places. And Jesus says to them, "You don't know what you're asking." He says, "Are you able to drink the cup that I will drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism that I will be baptized with?" And what I love about the Sons of Thunder is their response is, we are able. Yeah, bring it on. Give me that cup. Give me that baptism. I'll take it on. We're with you, Jesus. We're 100% in. And curiously, Jesus doesn't say, no, you're not able. He says, you will drink the cup that I will drink, and you will be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with. But then he says, I can't do for you what you ask. It's not mine to give. Those places aren't preserved for you. Because in some sense, it's not about place. And the other 10 hear what's going on, and they hear this discussion, and our translation says they began getting angry. And actually, the Greek is, they're not just angry, they're irate. They're like, what are you doing? James and John, and this is part of an ongoing process where, you know, earlier in Mark 8, again, after Jesus talks about his death and resurrection, the disciples then start arguing about who's the greatest. I'm the greatest. Which one of us is the greatest, right? It's all about our hierarchy. And Jesus at that point says, brings a little child and says, look, if you want to be great, you must become like one of these, a little child. So here they are arguing again about who's the greatest. They didn't get that message the first time. And Jesus says, if you want to be great, you need to become like a servant. If you want to be first, you must become like a slave. And there's a paradigm. Part of what he's doing, he's like, okay, you guys are in. Like, I love your excitement. I love that you want to be there in the midst of it, but you're missing something. This is a different way of thinking. This is a different kind of world than the one you imagine living in. And if you want to understand it, you gotta be the least. This last week, I was thinking about, as I'm thinking about this text and thinking about paradigms and what does it mean to live in different paradigms, I was at my doctor's office, or my dentist's office, and it is a blessing to have a good dentist, right? And I was sitting there, and he has McLean's in his office. I was reading the most current issue of McLean's magazine. And Chrystia Freeland, there's a profile of Chrystia Freeland this month in the center of the, or in the magazine. So I was reading that. And it was talking about Chrystia Freeland's paradigm in the trade negotiations, the recent trade negotiations with the United States, versus Robert Lighthizer's paradigm. And Robert Lighthizer shares Donald Trump's paradigm. And Donald Trump's paradigm in this world is that there are winners and that there are losers. And I'm a winner. And I'm going to be part of the winner, and you're going to be part of the losers. Donald Trump comes by that honestly. That was his father's creed. That was his father's paradigm. He was inculcated in that worldview by his father. It was reinforced when he went to a military boarding school. There are winners and there are losers, and you need to be the winner. And it's a fairly common paradigm. Donald Trump is not the only one in the world who manifests that paradigm. It's a very human paradigm. I think it goes all the way back to the cavemen, right? There are winners and there are losers. But Donald Trump couples it with, you know, his own, you know, grandiosity and flamboyance and his bullying, right? He is going to be a winner, and he's going to bully you in the process. And unfortunately, he's brought that into the American presidency. It's a tragedy, in my opinion. But anyway, Ronald Lighthizer, and so part of the trade negotiations, part of the reason why Donald Trump upset NAFTA, he's like, we feel like we're losing. We don't want to be losers. We want to be winners. And those Canadians and those Mexicans have, like, they're getting away with something. And, you know, we don't want to let them get away with anything. So we're gonna win, and we're going to make them lose. Ronald Lighthizer, Trump's trade advisor for the U.S., apparently shares that paradigm. So they approach these negotiations with Canada and Mexico with that attitude. It's, we're going to win, and you're going to lose. Chrystia Freeland, you know, Canada's trade representative in those discussions, doesn't share the paradigm. In fact, she refused to play by the paradigm. She came in there, and she said, well, okay, they're saying, we're going to win, and you're going to lose. And she's like, come on, guys, it doesn't have to be that way. I want you to win, and I want us to win. There's going to be winners, and there's going to be winners. And there doesn't have to be winners, and there doesn't have to be losers. And apparently, she would show up every day with this attitude, bright, sunny, entering the negotiations. And, you know, Ronald Lighthizer and the Americans are like, okay, we're going to kind of put you down and have this fight and competition. We're going to win. And Christie is like, let's find a different way. And she's smart, and she's tough, and I think it helps that she's a woman. And she was able to hold her own. I mean, McLean's article said it annoyed Robert Lighthizer to no end. It also made Donald Trump very distasteful toward her. Like, he said, oh, that Canadian trade representative. But she's modeling a different paradigm. Right? That's why I'm telling this story. This is not an endorsement of the current political regime in Canada. But it is saying that it's curious to see what somebody who holds that different paradigm coming up against, you know, that there's going to be those on top and those at the bottom. And she's like, no, I'm not going to play that game. Gandhi did a similar sort of thing, right? In his struggles for Indian independence from British colonialism. You know, he could have played a game where there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And we're going to fight you because we're going to amass power and strength, and we're going to fight you so that we can win and that you'll lose. But in choosing instead a path of nonviolence, what Gandhi is saying is, no, there can be justice for you and there can be justice for us. That you can win and we can win. There's a different sort of way of being in the world. He's operating under a different paradigm. Part of actually what influenced Gandhi's paradigm, it's clear that he understood what it meant to be a servant. That there this notion of like, okay, sometimes in order to be great, sometimes in order to enter into this different way of being, you need to take on the form of a servant if you're going to break the paradigm. The way to understand, the way to get out of the paradigm is not to go up, it's to go down and out through the bottom. So one of the things Gandhi did in his ashram is he cleaned the toilets. He seriously did. I hear a gasp. I love it. A gasp. So God, but that's part of what that actually did kind of help him. It was part of his spiritual discipline in terms of grounding and recognizing that some people aren't up here and some people are down here. Somebody's got to do the toilet cleaning. And I'm going to share in that. And we're all going to share in that. Jesus does a similar thing. Jesus does not ever in the Bible anywhere say clean the toilets. Let me be clear about that. There are other ways to being servant. You don't have to clean toilets to be a servant. But he does wash his disciples' feet. It's a very profound moment at the Last Supper where he chooses to stoop down and wash his disciples' feet, and it makes his disciples profoundly uncomfortable. Peter says, no, no, don't do it to me. And Jesus says, unless I wash you, you're not going to understand this thing. It's a part of what I hear in today's, like in this wrestling. Jesus is inviting his disciples to go counter to everything that shapes them, everything in their sense of what it means to be a man in this world, everything in terms of their sense of what greatness is, what glory is, you know, that you know, the sense of like, no, some people have positions of honor, some people are up and some people are down, and Jesus is saying, I want to free you and I want to liberate you from that paradigm. That notion of service is at the heart of the Christian message, right? I mean, Christianity, if it's anything, is about, you know, following Jesus, this model of sacrifice, it's self-sacrifice. And our other readings of Isaiah and Hebrews today are all about what Jesus has done in terms of busting an old paradigm and creating a new one, and creating a new opportunity. Jesus being a high priest who can sympathize and clear the way for us, the suffering servant from Isaiah. And our sense is, often, unfortunately, our sense is that to serve means you have to suffer. To serve means you're doing something that's very distasteful and unpleasant. To serve means that you're somehow being debased and demoted, that somehow you're taking the lower position and suffering. I think that's a part of it. There's definitely an invitation to go down to break the paradigm. But when we feel that way, when that's all we understand service to be, we're still playing by the old paradigm. Instead of choosing to be up, we've chosen to be down, and then we're stuck in the old paradigm, and we're experiencing the old paradigm. And I think what Jesus is inviting his disciples into is a sense of, no, actually, serve so that you can experience the fullness of life. Serve so that you can finally be free of being better than and less than, of being on top of and dominating versus being dominated. Serve so that you can finally recognize the glory of God and the image of God, not only in your neighbor, but also in yourself. So that you can finally step into following in the path of this God who takes on human flesh and enters into human form and becomes like a servant in order to set us free. It's not an invitation to debase yourself. It's an invitation to find life and a different way of being in this world. And for some reason, the only way we get there is to practice servant, you know, practice this kind of humbling process so that we can move beyond the winners, losers, those who are up and down, and finally get to win-win, you know, at some level. We're going to have an opportunity. We'll get there. I do this imperfectly. I realize in my life's journey in terms of what does it mean to serve, I'm not perfect at it. But I've known and I've discovered, especially as I get older, that those moments where I do step into those moments of service, I get a glimpse of the kingdom of God. A glimpse of a different way of being. And I know many of you in this congregation know this. You know the value of service. I'm always impressed by, you know, the number of hours and the commitment that many of people in the congregation have to working at Share at the food bank or volunteering at 3030 Gordon. I'm continually surprised by the number of people in the congregation who are in their 60s and 70s, and they have a person who's older than they are that they give rides to, that they help their finances, do their finances, that they help take to doctor's appointments. You know that act of service. You know the gift that comes from doing stuff like that. We're going to have another opportunity in March. We've been approached by the BC Housing Association, the Hope for Freedom here, has been approaching churches to sponsor the cold weather mat program. 3030 Gordon over in Poco, the homeless situation has grown to such an extent that, you know, the shelter at 3030 Gordon can't accommodate all the need anymore. So for the first time in many years, they're setting up a cold winter weather program. And they haven't been able to find enough churches who are volunteering, who's willing to volunteer. They've only found three churches, including Como, the United Church at the end of Como Lake, and they're doing 2 months. So there's four slots that are filled out of six. So we've gone through our own process of kind of doing, many of you have been asked, hey, would you be willing to volunteer? I mean, we've done an informal survey. We've talked about it in church committee, brought in the folks for Hope for Freedom. They've answered our questions, some tough questions about, well, what does that mean for our sanctuary? What does it mean for our neighbors? And we've reached a point where we realize actually this feels like it's where we're being called to host the MAP program. So we're going to do that in March. We found somebody who's going to be our key facilitator who has experience doing it from St. Andrews. We're going to collaborate and partner with other churches so that we don't have to do all of that volunteering ourselves. But it's an opportunity for us to serve our community. It's an opportunity for us to serve those who are currently without homes, to serve those who actually the larger culture sees as losers. it's an opportunity for us to actually clean toilets, right? And do that as a spiritual discipline if we want to. You know, there's an opportunity. But you don't have to clean the toilets, right? You can volunteer and do other things. So that's one. It's an opportunity that we have to step deeper into following in the way of Jesus. Amen.